Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode of the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show. And today I have Sam Shafiq with me. Would you like to introduce yourself, honey? Me and Sam have known each other for about 9 years.
Yes, it's been a long time.
We separated from, we left our exes around about the same time, didn't we?
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Kate. As you say, my name is Sam. I'm a full-time UK, why do I say UK? I'm a full-time teacher here in the UK. I teach reception, which is age 4 to 5. And I'm a survivor of domestic abuse in many different forms, which we'll touch upon. And I'm also a single mum to an 11-year-old, also survivor of domestic abuse.
Yeah, and that's it. You know, the children are massively affected by it, and unfortunately, this is a problem certainly within the family court, isn't it? That they're not seen as a victim at all.
No, I think there's a lot of work to be done there. I know the tide is changing very, very slowly. You know, lots of people in the legal profession are in the family courts, you know, always say, make sure you're going back to a child-centered approach. So I do think that there is a shift, but I think it's a very small shift, and a shift that's been a very, very long time coming.
And still, it's a lottery. It's a lottery as to who you get on the family court. If you strike lucky, you get somebody who has an ounce of common sense.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, in their brain, yeah, it's you're great. But if you, I mean, I was lucky. I was quite lucky with who I got in terms of the family contact hearings, both with CAFCAS and the judge. But many people aren't as fortunate.
And I think I'd probably fall into that bracket, actually, Kate. Sadly, our family court situation was happening during COVID. And it meant that I think there's a few different factors here. There's the fact that you're very, very vulnerable at that time, and you may not have the money to pay for solicitors, barristers, legal advice, but you feel like you need to because you know, it's a frightening time. You know, you're at your lowest.
Yeah.
And we had our final hearing in 2020, which was lockdown. It happened to be a day after my birthday. And myself and my barrister were in completely different rooms. She was at home. I was at my sister's flat because I didn't want to be at home during the school holidays for Hera to my daughter to hear everything that was going on. And, you know, I'd paid a lot of money for the privilege of having a barrister, and we were having to communicate through WhatsApp because we weren't able to be in the same room. And obviously the judge was in the courtroom, my ex-husband was at his home, and it was bizarre looking back, the whole situation. And with CAFCAS as well, sadly there were several changes of people. I understand that there's a very high turnover of staff within CAFCAS, and so the lady that spoke to us initially was not the same person that was then representing our statements in court. And I think there are a lot of things that get lost in translation. You know, the person who's presenting hasn't built that relationship with you, and it can be really, really tricky. And I do believe that the majority of mostly women, I know there are men in that position as well, I think fall into that bracket where the legal support is either not there or you're having to tell them what you need from them. And then with CAFCAS as well, it's almost like a tick box exercise, or feels like what is a tick box exercise. And then you know, you go to these child contact centres and all these different things that make up the process, you know, from when an application is made to court to the final hearing. Our journey, I call it, lasted, I think, 2 years from when I first had the letter from the family court to say an application has been made. It's funny, you remember those days like they were yesterday, don't
Yeah,
you? Significant moments. So, yes, there was a lot leading up to that. But no, sorry, Kate, I'll pass it back to you. It's a can of worms, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. And the issue is it's very similar to the criminal arena as well, is that, you know, unfortunately they don't view domestic abuse in a holistic way. And unfortunately, it's not enough to know the, I mean, it's obviously referring to family court, it's not enough to know the dynamics. You could be the best in understanding the dynamics of family court, but unfortunately, when you throw domestic abuse into the arena and trauma from adult victim and short trauma from, in regards to the child victims, you're entering different realms there. You know, you need to become the expert in psychology and trauma and domestic abuse, and, you know, understanding the psychology of the perpetrator, because, as we know, they come across as butter
most lovable, well adjusted members of society.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's probably the best way to put it. You know, very lovable, very generous, very giving with their time, and gifts and words and all of these things. Which is why I think it's a very hard then as a survivor or a victim of domestic abuse to share your story. And I think one of the biggest reasons why people choose not to, because it can be perceived as so unbelievable that this person who's this well-loved popular member of, you know, society is capable of doing those things. And I think it's one of the biggest reasons that a lot of women mostly don't speak out, because it just seems so incredibly unbelievable.
It does, absolutely, particularly if you've got somebody who is articulate. I mean, there are ones that aren't, they can't keep it together, and they, you know, they are,
the facts show,
they are, totally, yeah, they are in public, how they are behind closed doors, and that's very easy to see, you know, there's no ambiguity there. But when you've got somebody who is the more intelligent ones, the more intelligent perpetrators, they are very astute. They know how they need to show up, and they know how they need to present themselves in different settings.
Yeah.
And they do that very, very well.
Mm.
Yeah. And that can throw professionals off guard if they don't have the right knowledge in understanding the psychology and the way a perpetrator conducts themselves, particularly as a victim might be, you know, incredibly distressed.
Mm.
They might come across as they become look as though they are the unstable one.
I've talked to a lot of women that have been in similar positions, and I think the word that is thrown around is it makes us look like we're unhinged.
Absolutely. It does. Absolutely.
You know, what on earth are you talking about? You know, this is an upstanding member of society. They've got a good job. They've held that job down for X amount of years.
Yeah.
You know, they give to charity and they do this and they do that. And you just, you then trying to make a stand for yourself and for your child or children makes you come across that you are completely unhinged, and, you know, you're making these things up because you don't want that person to have contact with your child.
Absolutely.
And you're using your child as a tool to get at them, and all of these things that get thrown at us.
Yeah, which is everything that actually they are doing. They're the ones that are using the children as tools.
Absolutely. I think I've started saying to people that, you know, every accusation is actually a confession of something that they
100% it is. 100% it is.
Or have done. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a hidden confession. They accuse people of everything that they are guilty of
That they
themselves.
are doing. It's a deflection tactic. And it is really odd, because you don't see it at the time at all. And I'm sure you know, Kate, for me, from my past life, I used to be an area manager. I used to be what I am, well educated, coming from a nice, stable, secure childhood. We wanted for nothing. My parents provided us. We're not saying that we were spoiled. My dad worked incredibly hard. My dad supported, my grandparents as well as a large extended family. We learned the value of things. We learned the value of family. Never in trouble at school. Just, re respecting society, respecting parents, respecting teachers. Worked my way up in my career. I'd always been in retail, and I was a retail area manager when I met my ex-husband. And it was all this love bombing. It was all could not give me enough attention and gifts, and always at the end of the phone. And it felt lovely. It felt lovely to have the attention. It felt lovely. It made me feel secure. It made me feel like, actually, yes, I think I can see myself spending the rest of my life with this person. And it wasn't very long after we got married. I think it was 3 weeks into our marriage that the text messages from other women started cropping up on the telephone. And at that time, I think more so culturally than anything else, I think I panicked and I thought, oh my goodness, we've only just got married. I can't go to my parents and tell them that, after this lovely big wedding and all the relatives, what will people say? And it's this big stigma in our culture of what will people say?
I don't
And
even think that's a cultural thing. I think that's just generally, and it's people are. I know I did. I was very, very similar to you, actually. I found out about the other woman first. The first woman I found out about that he was talking to was about 2 months before the wedding, and I remember he just looked at me blankly when I asked him who she was, and I hoped. As we do after the wedding,
It was
it'll be
completely
better.
innocent.
Everything will change, and then it's the next milestone. It's well, when the baby's born, things will change.
Absolutely, everything will be hunky-dory. Absolutely. So I had an added element where my ex-husband had already, so I was his second wife. He'd already had a child with his first wife, and it was really bizarre looking back because he'd turn on the tears and accuse his ex-wife of not letting him have contact with his child. And obviously for me that, oh my goodness, this is outrageous. How can she possibly do this? You're such a loving, kind, caring person. How can she possibly do this? And it was and then the most bizarre thing, we'd start getting letters from so his son was disabled, so we'd start getting letters from the special needs school to say there's an open day and you're invited and so on, and he'd refuse to go. And that was the first red flag for me. You're contradicting what you've been saying, that you don't have contact with him. You've got an opportunity here, but you're not taking it. So it was a bit of a red flag. And then, of course, our daughter came along a year later. And so many horrific things happened. A lot of it was verbal. There was lots of sort of emotional abuse. There was lots of silent treatments and making me feel like I was guilty for wanting to protect our child, oftentimes from him. It was just the worst time because you want to be able to enjoy this time as a new mum. It's your first time experiencing motherhood and you want to be able to enjoy that. And I was made to go back to work when Hira was only 4 months old because
They actually rob us
that,
of
yeah.
that
Absolutely.
luxury,
Kind
of
of
that
that.
privilege of bonding and enjoying that time as a new mom as well, don't they?
And actually, the most interesting thing I found is that I've actually blocked out, so I have no memory now of a chunk of that time after our daughter was born. And I know it's to do with trauma, and I know it's to do with that constant verbal abuse that my brain has just switched it off. You know, but there are other things that I remember so prominently, calling her the most vile names, because as a baby he couldn't settle her, couldn't soothe her, wouldn't change her, wouldn't feed her, she would cry, couldn't comfort her. And he called her the most vile names. He actually brought her into my workplace at one point in the car seat, middle of winter, with just a baby grow on and a soaking wet nappy. Her face was absolutely tears streaming, you know, nose was running everywhere. So clearly she'd been very upset for some time for her to get into that state. And he actually dumped the car seat on the desk at work. Thankfully, there was nobody around, and called her one of the most disgusting words I won't repeat on here. And for me, that was the turning point. I thought, if you can treat your own daughter as a baby in that manner, I don't feel like you are the person that I want to raise this child with. But again, you give him another chance. Awesome. You give him another chance. And this went on until she was three. At this point, mother-in-law joins in, father-in-law joins in, sister-in-law joins in. You know, you're the worst daughter-in-law, you're the worst wife. You need to give all your money to him because he's paying the bills. And meanwhile, he's had his second trip to Dubai that year. But it's your fault that
entitlement again, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And even his parents are handing him that entitlement. They've enabled that entitlement.
Exactly. I think they had a huge part to play. Mike's father-in-law washed his hands of the whole situation. Mike's mother-in-law, the first time I found out he was having an affair after Hero was born, I spoke to her and she basically told me to shut my mouth and let him carry on doing what he wants to do. You know, it was awful. There were several times when his parents, my parents, both of us, we'd all get together to try and air things out and see if there was any sort of solutions, and things would get better for a little while. And then I actually miscarried after Hera, and I found out that the evening that I told him, he was in bed with somebody else. It is just, and I think that, because I've always been quite an independent person, you know, I've been career minded. I've always believed that if you want something, you've got to work hard for it. And this is something that obviously I'm trying to instill in my daughter as well. But for me, it was not having the financial independence. Things like if I said I was going to visit my parents, he would take the car and disappear for hours on end. So we had no means to get anywhere. It got to the point where my parents were sending food parcels to us every week, and I'd, you know, section it out into Tupperware boxes and freeze it so it would last the week. She, the poor girl, was living on KFC, you know, $2.99 chicken popcorn and chips meals. And I, you know, my clothes, I had, I remember it vividly. I had a denim shirt dress and the sleeve was all torn, and I'd just roll it up to hide the tears so that I could pay for her child benefit again. Oh, he's the one paying all the bills, you need to transfer that to his account.
Yeah, that happened with me as well. He had the child benefit as well.
Yeah, I was completely isolated. We don't talk to this person, we don't talk to that person. So one of his sister-in-law's mum passed away, and the entire family was there paying their respects. They didn't even tell me that she'd passed away. So it was glaringly obvious that there's one person missing here who hasn't bothered coming to make me look bad.
Yeah.
It was just horrendous.
Yeah. Now, I know this has really affected Hera, hasn't it? Massively.
Yeah,
and it's
it
yeah, it still does.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about that after this short commercial break.
Wonderful.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Good, your day the right way with Revive Active's range of super supplements and get the most out of life. Take one power-packed sachet, mix with water, and enjoy a super tasty health drink at work, at home, or on the go. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to optimize your health and well-being to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, and more. No filler, no stimulants, no artificial colors or preservatives, just the right mix of vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and hero ingredients to help you put back what life takes out. Try our 7-day or 30-day boxes and use code UK Radio to get a free supplement shaker. Revive Active. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
The station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back after that short break. Now, Hera, how has it affected Hera? Obviously I know how it's affected Hera. Do you want to talk a bit more about that?
Yes, absolutely. So Hera was three when we separated from her dad, but prior to that, obviously she was always within this very, very toxic environment. Daddy never being around, daddy giving mummy the silent treatment, daddy being abusive towards her. She felt unsafe. She wouldn't, if you can picture it, dad comes home from work and child runs into daddy's arms, and mum gets forgotten about. She would run away from him and into my arms because she felt unsafe. And I think we tried to sort of come to an arrangement prior to that, but obviously he wanted everything on his terms, wasn't happy with what we'd agreed. So in 2018, I got a letter from the family courts, and it was really, really sort of staggered. I'd demonstrated to the courts about how much anxiety Hera had, how much trauma she had. To know that there's a five-year-old that's actually suffering from anxiety was quite heartbreaking, and just really demonstrated quite how much trauma she had experienced. And I do think that in every scenario, children are often seen as a side effect rather than one of the victims of the domestic abuse. So she has had a very, very turbulent time at primary school. She absolutely hated year two when this was all going on. And she'd often go into school and she'd say things to teachers. And I remember being called in by one of the head teachers, and later on found out that the school thought that I was putting my anxieties onto Hera, which was really difficult because at that point in time, obviously parental alienation was a term that the courts were, it was being thrown about. And I think that's the thing, that one of the things that dad has maintained from day one, that I am trying to alienate her from him, from his family, that I don't want them to have, want her to have anything to do with them, which wasn't the case at all. It was, I want her to have a relationship with you as her father, but I want that relationship to be safe for her.
Yeah.
So her schooling journey, she's most recently just left primary school, but year six, I think the older she's got, the more she's actually understood the abuse herself, and sad to say was experiencing it again at the contact that was court arranged with dad. And she became more and more verbal. She because of all the things that she'd experienced, I, working at a school as at the time a learning support assistant, knew that there was different types of support available to her. So I pushed for Hera School to try and put these things in place. And I think it was one of the things that worked in my favour. When we had the final hearing, the judge looked at the paperwork. He looked at, you know, Women's Aid, Helping Hands, Nurture Groups, CBT, all these things that I'd asked for to support Hera, to have the contact with Dad and to be able to have the tools to cope with it all. The judge said, you know, I know that you've got her best interests at heart. I know that you're not trying to alienate her, but she does have the right to have that relationship with her father. So it kind of, I don't know, it brushed off all of this trauma. And, you know, we, as I mentioned when I introduced myself, I'm a primary school teacher. And one of the things that you have to do every year without fail is safeguarding training. And actually, one of the notches I've got on my belt, Kate, is I'm actually trained as a DSL, designated safeguarding lead. So I'm not active in my current school, but I was one of the active safeguarding leads at my previous school. And that really opened my eyes to several things. One is how massively underfunded these services are to support children properly. You know, and I'm not talking six sessions with mental health support and that's it, you're signed off. You know, we've given you the tools and off you go. But also at how little the training, the real in-depth training is. Now, obviously, as a designated safeguarding lead, I was given a lot more extensive training than what your average learning support assistant or teacher or caretaker, anyone that comes in contact with children in school would have. But even then, it was not from a perspective of what risk is this child under? What yeah. is their trauma and what can we best do to support that child? It was very much, okay, well, I've noticed a bit of a difference in this child's appearance, or I've noticed a bit of a difference in this child's behaviour. Let's keep an eye. Let's log it and let's keep an eye. There's never that let's really get under the surface of what's going on so that we can close that gap. There's a picture that really, really stays in my mind. And it's a picture of a child's, it's like a scan of a child's brain, a healthy five-year-old child who comes from a loving two-parent nurturing family background, and it's a normal developed brain. And there's a picture of another child's brain next to it. And this is a child who suffered domestic abuse, adverse childhood experiences, and the synapses are missing and there's gaps in the development. And just looking at that picture, you know, I've got children in my class currently, obviously won't name any names for GDPR, but I've got children in my class currently who at even that age come from a trauma background.
Yeah.
And I can see it in their behaviour. I can see it in how much they crave that connection. Yeah. But the education system is so stacked against, you know, there's not the time or the resources to protect these children. No. And one of the reasons I went into teaching was to help prevent more children experiencing what Hera has experienced, or to help to bridge that gap a little bit. Or, you know, that child loved coming into school today because they felt safe. That's the only safe place they have. You know, that tiny little bit of difference. Yeah. But yeah. I don't believe that schools are fully trained, equipped, no. To deal with trauma and abuse.
I don't believe that they are trained at all to deal with children with trauma at all. No. They treat them, they put them into pigeonholes, and they expect every single child who they deem as on the spectrum, being academically behind, but not having that label to assign to them as being neurodiverse and on the spectrum, they get lost. They get lost. But what they're not doing is they're not.
But actually, they're the children that are more at risk.
They are. Well, they are, because they've. The thing is, it's not the label. I mean, you know, I don't like referring to labels. I don't like using labels to describe anybody's. No. Psychological well-being and how they function. Because ultimately, the brain works exactly the same, regardless of what label you want to assign to it. The brain works on risk and reward, and the brain works, its main primary object is to keep us safe.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've got a child that's acting out and being aggressive.
That's why I was trying to tell you something.
Yeah, they feel safe enough to express themselves. And this sometimes can be the problem because they feel it's safe to express the anger and the rage that they feel inside them. They're not learning if they're going too far with that
absolutely
expression. They're not learning that actually behaviors have consequences. Yeah. There's no consequences. There's nothing to stop them. Now, the only way the brain is going to not instruct you to behave in a certain way or prevent or stop you from, you know, going too far is if you know that you associate the consequences with a greater pain than the wound they are trying to soothe.
Yeah.
The consequences don't represent a greater pain. There's nothing to deter them from engaging in that behavior.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, more often in society now, we are seeing children that are not afraid of their parents, and they're not that they want to be, they should be afraid of them. That's the wrong word to use. We don't want them to be afraid of them, but they need to respect.
Yes, being respect to the right word.
And they don't have any respect for boundaries.
No,
because boundaries are consequences essentially.
Yeah,
and the consequences are not severe enough to deter them from engaging in behavior. They know if they just keep pushing those out, eventually that person will break and they'll get their own way. Unfortunately what they're learning. I mean, I was actually at the hospital today, and the radiologist that I had was Indian, and only because the nurse that brought me in sort of caught part of the conversation. I was having a conversation with a lady in the waiting room about this, actually, because it always happens.
It does.
And anyway, so because I was talking to the nurse as we were walking into the room, he started asking me, and he says, you know, it's funny actually, because he says, I don't have children, but obviously, I'm from Indian background, and he says, obviously, I've got friends that have got children, and I've got other family members that I've got nieces and nephews and things, and they respect, there's utmost respect for their parents.
The elders. Parents, elders, aunts, uncles, etc.
But he says, in contrast, I will observe my English friends, got children, and the children run riot. They run rings around them, and there's absolutely no respect and no boundaries that are respected at all. So, you know, it goes to show the importance of, and I know a lot of people, and you've been a teacher, you'll hear this a lot, about gentle parenting. And I think gentle parenting can cause a lot of problems.
It can.
Because parents are afraid to challenge their children because they think, oh, well, if I challenge them, I'm causing them distress. But unfortunately, sometimes it's unavoidable because the other consequences are.
It's better to put those boundaries in now when they're 5 years old than
absolutely.
When they're 15.
Exactly.
It's so much better to do that. And this is one of the reasons why my motto in my classroom is connection over correction. And what I mean by that is if a child is exhibiting something, notice it and connect. And I know it's hard to do when you've got 30 children and they've all got their individual needs and demands and whatnot. But if you notice that behavior and you connect with those children, you most likely then won't have to correct a worse behavior down the line because they feel heard, they feel seen. And it, you know, it's the same with bringing it back to trauma. Children need to be heard in this entire process because we can avoid situations like what my child has experienced this last year, as you know, Kate.
And the thing is, if you've got a child that is in clear distress, whether they are, you know, crying hysterically or whether they are displaying violence, and screaming aggressively at you, their behaviour can trigger, and you know, a lot of parents will, certainly mothers will be listening to this and can relate to it. Mm. And we've all been guilty of it. We've all been guilty of reacting verbally and challenging because their behaviour makes us feel, that wounded party in us, feel attacked.
Yeah.
We feel like they are attacking us. And we react in the moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
What I always say to people is there's no point. You are operating from the emotional part of your brain. They are operating the emotional part of your brain.
They're both going like this, aren't
neither of you are in a right state position to communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You're better off removing yourself to another room.
Yeah. Breathe.
Bringing it down rather than and that's where it's important for both parent and child to have tools to self-regulate. Self-regulate separately and then come back together
does start from, you know, reception, but it's knowing how to use those tools, knowing how to model that to the children.
Yeah.
You know, we've got calm corners in all reception classes, you've got fidget tools, you've got breathing exercises where you've got the triangle shape where you breathe up to go up the triangle, breathe down, breathe up, breathe down. And it, you know, we do a circle time, for example, where I'll, you know, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in. And they absolutely love it. And it's the most wonderful thing seeing 4 and 5 year olds go off into the reading corner and sit there and help each other breathe.
Excellent.
And notice signals in each other. Miss, so-and-so's really sad. Oh, okay, why do you think they're sad? Oh, because they're sat in the corner, they're, you know, their shoulders are slumped and they've got a sad face. Mm-hmm. Teaching children, it's emotional regulation, isn't it?
I think
it's just knowing, it's moving away from these really archaic behavior systems that some schools have. And knowing that any behavior that child is exhibiting is a form of them trying to communicate to you. I always say behavior is a form of communication. And certainly where you've got children from backgrounds of domestic abuse, you know, that child's not just punched that wall for the fun of it. That child's punched that wall because somebody's probably punched them this morning. You know, sorry to be crass, that child has...
They're enraged, and they feel safe enough to express those feelings of anger and rage.
The only way they know how.
Exactly.
And we need to give them the tools. And I, you know, as a parent, as well as a teacher, I don't think schools are well equipped. But I think schools need to be, because when you look at the family court system, and we were saying this just earlier, CAFCAS, who are equipped to write reports on the emotional and mental well-being of this child and how they present.
Don't know the children.
One tiny snapshot, an hour if that, with the child, mostly at school, where children feel like they have to be on their best behaviour anyway.
They are a complete stranger coming in. How do they expect them to open up to them when they are a complete stranger?
Absolutely. Whereas, and CAFCAS then are required, for those that don't know the family court system, are required to write a report recommending actions to the judge, which the judges actually take very highly. They take the report very seriously.
Yeah.
And oftentimes decisions are made based on that report.
Yeah.
On the child contact arrangement. Whereas if schools who spend the majority of time with these children notice changes in behaviour, changes in appearance, this child hasn't had their coat for the last 2 weeks and it's been absolutely chucking it down with rain, do we need to start, you know, is there neglect, the changes in the appearance or whatever? The child's always teary and crying. If schools were trained on how to risk assess or you know, look at the risk that the child is facing, the impact of the trauma on that child, And schools were a bigger part of this entire process, I think would be a much, much better outcome for the children. Involved.
We're going to break for a short commercial break again, and we're going to carry on the conversation about what needs to improve in schools, because there's quite a lot that needs to improve in school.
I think so too.
And the system as a whole. And we'll see you in a short while.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with the skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. So, what needs to change in schools? What, in your professional and personal opinion, because obviously you've had personal
dealings.
Yeah, you can see both sides of the camp.
Mm.
What needs to change in schools to improve outcomes for women and children?
So I think, from a professional perspective, and I'm sure there are many teachers, if you're listening to this, will totally see where I'm coming from, is that already teachers are expected to be teacher, mum, social worker, parent. We're teaching, oftentimes teaching children skills that parents aren't teaching at home. We're counsellors, we're librarians, we're finding lost property people. We've got so many hats already.
Yeah.
That to add another layer to that, it will probably break the system, if I'm honest with you. However, I do feel that every single school, every single borough, every single county, local authority, every single first response teams, whatever, need people that are trained in trauma and risk assessing children and women, anyone that's involved in that child's bigger picture.
I mean, like you say, it's a fine balance because like you say, they are, teachers are snowed under as it is, with, having to wear lots of different hats. Somebody only said to me the other day that, teachers are expected to, in going into reception, that they're getting kids that aren't even potty trained.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But unfortunately, it is, as we said earlier on, it's children, it's teachers who know the children the best.
Yes.
So they are better equipped than any court professional or court representative in making a judgment on the child's emotional and psychological well-being, because they see them every day.
And I think that takes me to the personal point of view as a mum. So, you know, here being in year six, there were many, many, many situations where a class teacher or somebody working with her, you know, learning support assistant, nurture leader or whatever, would come to me and say, she's made this disclosure, what do you want us to do?
Yeah.
And often, every single time, I would push back and say, I'm at this point in time, I'm Mr. Beek, I'm an employee here.
Yeah.
If I was in another workplace, would you phone me or would you make a decision that's in her best interests? Obviously,
yeah.
To piece it all together, I'm a primary school teacher at the school that Hera was at. I worked there for a year of her time at that school, which happened to be year six. And it happened to be the time where, obviously, because she was older, she was understanding things more, she was communicating things more, making more disclosures, because she understood it, because, you know, her emotional ability was more because of her age. And she'd make disclosures and, you know, there was one conversation where, obviously, I won't say who it was, but this person said, do you think this is emotional abuse, isn't it? And I thought, oh, my goodness,
yeah.
What have I been saying?
Yeah.
But it's such a fine line. You feel like you're walking a tightrope because you cannot put those words in their mouths. And it's such a fine line because, you know, with the court system and the way so many terms are thrown at mums, that, you know, you're coaching the child and you're doing this. And so therefore, obviously, as an employee as well as mum, I was in a very difficult position where I mustn't lead those conversations. I mustn't put words in anyone's mouth. Yeah. It all had to come from her. But it was really difficult to see what was done with that information sometimes. And I did then, I thought, actually, you know, my priority is always my child. Yeah. So mum hat went on. And again, it was sort of a, well, what about this? Or what about that? Or actually, I think this requires a phone call to first response because it's beyond. And, you know, even one of the head teachers once said to me, I can understand why you're in, you know, in between a rock and a hard place, yeah, because you want to try and protect her, but you can't because there's a court order in place, and we as a school have no power to influence anything. So I really do feel, I completely agree, Kate, it is a very fine line, and how, if it was ever to happen, I don't know how it would be orchestrated.
I mean, I think the most sensible, because there's lots of value for teachers to have trauma-informed skills and abilities and as a trauma-informed toolkit at their fingertips. Because actually, let's look at what the primary objective of a teacher is. It is to improve the academic development of the children. Oh, well, if they are in a state of distress, well, they exactly. So I think the perfect scenario within schools would be all teachers to be trained to be trauma informed, to understand what constitutes abuse.
And not just
exactly. Then have a designated, when those teachers spot, oh, there's a problem here, then have a designated, as you've already got safeguarding leads who are trained to.
Who's also had that training.
And write the appropriate report with the assistance of the teacher who has that regular daily interaction with the child. I think that's the best scenario. But obviously it is the safeguarding lead that would lead it.
I agree. I think there are a lot of things that could be avoided, that could have been avoided had that been the case. With Hera. I mean, we got there in the end, but it was a long slog, I have to say. And I completely agree. If there were things in place as a trauma-informed school, a proper trauma-informed school, not just a we've done this course and we've got the accreditation, proper deep-rooted trauma.
Well, trauma-informed school yeah. that has a knowledge on domestic abuse and, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, in a nutshell, in a very long nutshell.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on, Sam. It's been great to have you. And I will catch my listeners on the next episode next week.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about Kate's work, head to her bio on UK Health Radio. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and always remember, you're not alone.